Okay, we're ready to go. I am now officially in.
You are listening to Our Rich Land, a podcast of Richland Soil and Water Conservation District and Kingwood Center Gardens, where we explore what it means to improve, protect, and conserve our natural world in our small corner of Ohio. Today, it's just Josh and I.
What's up?
So I'm going to read you a quote and then you get to guess.
Ooh.
It is simply that in all life on earth, as in all good agriculture, there are no shortcuts that bypass nature and the nature of man himself and animals, trees, rocks, and streams. Every attempt at a formula, a shortcut, a panacea always ends in negation and destruction.
That sounds like Louis Bromfield. Am I right?
That you are correct.
Oh man, I don't know how I came to that conclusion. Wasn't discussed ahead of time. I just knew this.
Yeah, it definitely was not.
Yeah, isn't that? I mean, that's exactly it. Like, we're all interconnected. We're all interdependent. We're unlike the rest of the created order, where we have moral agency and consciousness of right, and mm-hmm. we're a part of it. We're a part of the whole system.
Yeah.
So we can't. It's not wild out there and cultivated here. It's all part of the same thing. So those mm-hmm. those two, right? There isn't a part of the planet that isn't pristine wilderness.
Yeah.
As a concept. Bogus. Right? We've there hasn't been pristine wilderness probably since Columbus touched down. Even Native Americans impacted the world, the world they lived in. Right, they actually impacted their ecosystems. Shocker, shocker. they just didn't necessarily have ways that were, as far as we know, detrimental.
Yeah,
It was a positive reinforcing feedback loop, unlike the spiral we're in seems to be in now.
So we tossed out a name here that some of you probably know because you're locals, but some may not. So Louis Bromfield is, a Mansfield native, so he was born in Mansfield, Ohio. And his life gets crazy from there, pretty much.
As most of it does, by the way. We're born and then it gets crazy. It's kind of weird how that works.
So Louis is this guy who grows up in Richland County, goes to high school at Mansfield Senior High. He goes to college. He drops out. He goes back to college. He gets bored with college, and then he signs up to go fight in World War I in France.
That's the path that I was hoping to follow.
That's a 20-year-old for you. So he goes, signs up for ambulance service, so that he can get there sooner. I actually said that. He wants to get over there as soon as possible.
A lot of guys did.
He participates in several major battles. Is then discharged after the war, and then he just wanders around France, rural France, and said that he's wanders around for a while and kind of observes. I'm not exactly sure how or if
he's reading word for word from the website, by the way.
I am not actually. I did my research ahead of time.
I'm doing it right now.
So the website we are referencing here is Malabar Farm Foundation's website, and the link can be found in the show notes, and we're also going to touch on it later at the end of the episode. So he's discharged. He wanders around the French countryside observing local small-scale farming practices, of all things. And he eventually gets back to New York, and he's in New York City at this point. He begins a writing career, gets married, has kids, starts writing best-selling novels. He starts off with fiction and writes some really critically acclaimed fiction. So he's at this point a really promising young American writer, and he's hailed as such, and he wins a Pulitzer Prize.
Huh, I know that.
And so with all his best-selling books and all the money he now has, he takes his family to France for an extended holiday. They fall in love with France, and the website seems to suggest that they just don't come back.
And the family?
The family, the whole family. And they lease out a house or a farm for like 50 years.
Huh.
Or like plan to stay there for a long, long period of time. So, but as we all know, in the late 1930s in Europe, things start to go south.
Or east.
Or east. That's true. So he decides to move his family back to the States and is like, I remember Ohio. That was a nice place to live. I'm going to go back there.
I'm not laughing because that's like, is Evan's narration of his internal workings is interesting, you know.
So back to Ohio he goes, and they buy up three farms near Lucas, and collectively call them Malabar Farm. And I couldn't find anything on where the name Malabar comes from.
Well, I know there's a annual vine that's you can use for the foliage for salads.
Okay.
It's called Malabar spinach.
Oh.
And
okay.
I don't know if it's from that or if that's coming from a lot of these things have a regional name. Maybe Malabar is a I'm gonna Google it.
There you go. Yeah, because there's probably someone.
Oop, that was not what I was trying to hit. But, to knock that. How do you get out of this? I'm stuck in this loop. What does Malabar mean? Definition of Malabar: a native or inhabitant of the Malabar coast of southwestern India.
That's interesting because from France, one of the two places that he wanted to go and start farming was either Ohio or India.
Very close and similar. I mean, I could see where you would be torn between the two.
Right. A place where it snows 9 months out of the year or
9 months.
A tropical
paradise. 9 months out of the year. in permaculture, there's a one of the design principles that they talk about is using slow and small solutions. And that's hits at the, and also design from patterns to details, right?
Yeah.
And, and you can all find this on the internet at permaculturedesignprinciples.com or .org or something. But anyway, but that's, he's speaking to the like using those slower solutions that are not so obvious, right?
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of our current techniques is like the sooner we can get, this noxious weed out of there, the better. And sometimes there isn't a lot of thought of what's going to go in its place because nature hits a vacuum.
Right.
It's not enough just to, great, we got Phragmites out of there. Great. Well, it's altered the ecosystem so severely. Now what's going to be able to live in its place? A lot of these species alter the soil, right? The soil chemistry. Or was the soil chemistry altered and in a way that was more beneficial to the invasive versus, there's a lot of unknowns, right? Yeah. That we're not necessarily studying because we're not looking for it.
Right.
So anyway, back to your Bromfield.
Yeah. And I'm sure Louis had some idea of that as well. So he comes back to America as a promising writer. He's still writing fiction and some nonfiction works he starts to write, specifically about his time on the farm. According to the Malabar Foundation website, and I could be saying that wrong, it might be Malabar Farm Foundation, so I apologize if that's incorrect. But he writes this book called Pleasant Valley, and I think I'd really like to read it. It's a lot about as he coins the term new agriculture that he starts to put in place.
How does he describe that and define it?
New agriculture?
Yeah.
So there's several practices that he sort of coins or starts to use that are pretty far ahead of his time.
Such as?
One of them is, I don't think this is his term, but it's called trash farming, which turns into the no-till movement.
Okay.
So trash farming is like leaving the debris from harvest out on the field. Yeah. That's one of them. Another one is green manure. So compost, using
cover
compost.
Crops.
Yeah, cover crops. Okay, so I want to explain sustainable agriculture and sustainable practices for just a second here. First off, you're probably wondering what sustainable agriculture is in the first place. So the most basic definition is probably the practice of farming with ecological mindfulness, or incorporating practices into your farming operation that give back to nature. Louis Bromfield's trash farming is an example of this. So instead of plowing a field under in the fall, a farmer can choose to leave the leftover chaff and stalks from harvesting the crop on the field, which helps to retain and regain nutrients in the soil and deter soil erosion. Cover crops do similar things and are planted usually in mid to late fall and are often a cereal grain like wheat or rye. Or it can be a crop like oilseed radish or clover. Cover crops help break up the soil, reducing the need to use traditional deep plowing methods, which really harm soil health and structure. And they also fix and add nutrients to the soil. So some of the now more mainstream agricultural conservation practices he's experimenting with at Malabar.
I guarantee you had seen done in France on, you know, like cover crops, you know, are nothing new. There's a great book called First Gardeners, or America's First Gardeners. And it's actually looks at Washington, Monroe, Jefferson, Adams.
So this book here is actually called Founding Gardeners, The Revolutionary Generation, Nature and the Shaping of the American Nation by Andrew Wolfe, and focuses on only four founding fathers, and Monroe is actually not one of them. It's Madison.
They're talking about their love for farming and love for gardening, and just the use of, like, you know, daikon radishes, for example. You know, we know daikon radishes are used now as cover crop for busting up soil, right? Well, they did it then too, or beets that were, you know, designed for that. But then they would also allow the animals to forage on it. And I remember seeing a couple of years ago in one of my father-in-law's, you know, ag magazines, we were doing this new research where we're taking beets or radishes or whatever it was, and we're letting pigs feed on it and leave their stuff in the field. Isn't that amazing? I'm like, our forefathers knew about that. We're just coming back to it, right?
Right.
The advent of the steel plow, you know, the chilled steel plow,
yeah,
combustion engine, and the military industrial complex that comes out of World War II, and the, you know, the better life through chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that was one of the big ag revolutions,
mm-hmm,
in the last millennium. And it's suddenly like we're going, oh, maybe that's not so cool. And we're getting back to, and like, look what we just discovered.
Right.
I hate to tell you that, but, you know, our forefathers were doing that. So, but it's still good. And what's also good is, okay, now we're trying to, you know, bring in the scientific method to really delve in and understand why is that working, right? And put some more objective verification to what we've kind of already known.
Hey, this is Evan calling. Just want to let you know that we really appreciate you listening. We would also appreciate it if you shared this podcast with someone or a bunch of someones you know. As of July this year, we have a handful more episodes recorded and in the works, so keep an eye out. Alrighty, have a fantastic day. Talk to you later. Bye.
We talked about Lee Bromfield, who is kind of the namesake of Malabar Farm, which is here in Richland County, Ohio. And he was, along with contemporaries like Hugh Hammond Bennett, who was the first director of the Soil Conservation Service, and like Aldo Leopold, and some big names in ecology and soil and water conservation. He, like them, was touting this these up and rising ideas of, hold on, we got to pay attention to this stuff. And so that kind of started the train moving as far as conservation in itself. And now we're sort of in this era of, okay, we might have taken a sidetrack or derailed from that, and now we're living in a far more globalized world, and we need far more complex solutions to
multi-pronged approach.
Multi-pronged.
Whoa,
approach.
Whoa, what a concept! And more of a system, right? There's something in Bromfield's story that's really important. A life lesson I take away, because he like others of his generation actually promoted certain invasive species, because like Russian olive and some of these other. So he was a man, so to speak, trapped in his time. He had some forward thinking ideas, but it is sort of scientific method in the long stretch scale, right? We learn by trial and error. Oh, we now realize that what we thought was a great idea, not, or at least part of it's not so great. And so hopefully each generation gets a little better at thinking. I guarantee you there are things that I do in my own gardening practices that are probably horrible, you know, but
for 50 years.
Yeah. Good luck. You know, well, but the speed at which we're gaining knowledge, though, I think helps this is going to, you know, trim that time frame of ignorance down, hopefully better.
Yeah.
So there's a plus on that side.
What I think is cool is that right here in Richland County, we have a nationally and probably internationally renowned guy who was a famous author and someone who took his position of fame to champion sort of sustainable practices in agriculture, which I think sustainable agriculture is a great way to show the world a multi-pronged approach to conservation.
Had to do with this, you know, accepted speech of like what was public horticulture going to be, you know, in the future, what was it going to be about? And the thrust of what I talked about was exactly that this idea, for one, that, you know, like I said earlier, that there is pristine wilderness that man's not touched is kind of, you know, a misnomer, a misconcept. It doesn't exist anywhere anymore. We've indirectly touched every square inch of this land, either through our effects on climate or on rain or, you know, just all kinds of things, right? So we need to look at regenerative, I think it was part of where you wanted to go in this segment, regenerative, you know, agricultural, horticultural practices. There's a paradigm shift occurring where the aim and the goal isn't to turn back the hands of time to a certain moment and freeze dry it, and that, you know, flash freeze in that, and to preserve it in that forever as a museum piece of nostalgic childhood, you know, wonderment.
Mm-hmm.
But the recognition that things are always changing, have always been changing, and creating, redesigning systems. We have to go in and start designing ecosystems, right? Working on ecological principles, working with nature to better systems that that not only feed the other creatures in that system, but us also as a creature of that system, right? This doesn't have to be an either or thing; it can be an and both.
The concept of working with nature,
right,
is always kind of fascinated me and sparked like my imagination. I just think it's a really cool concept that we can help nature and nature can help us, and we can both sort of move in the same direction. And it's also really cool to me that we as a race of humans have that ability to cultivate our world in such a way as to even design and shape nature.
Right. I mean, we as far as we know, no other member of the animal kingdom has that kind of conscious, like I said, moral consciousness, and framework and ability to think to actually impact the you know, everything else is based on sort of on instinct without, you know, the just doing, right? And so the level of agency, therefore, it's on us to participate in a positive way. But also, I've thought a lot about this, not to get too big for my britches and thinking I have more control and influence than I have.
Yeah.
Who do we think we are, right?
Yeah.
The Earth is going to be here with or without human beings. I'd like to be on the Earth with the, you know, I'd like human beings to be around, right? But so, you know, the system's bigger than us. And so a little humility too, in terms of we're not gods, right? And we're just a part of, we're a small part of a great whole.
I think, and it's not just my opinion, it's or your opinion, it's I think where conservation is already headed, to what extent I'm not sure, but of more of a, hey, we need to not just conserve and protect nature, but we have to figure out a way for nature and humanity to thrive in the same space without destroying everything.
Without destroying each other.
Yeah, without destroying each other. Yeah.
that's exactly, that is the only real option pathway forward, you know, which means there's going to be a give and take. It's not going to be pristine wilderness. Nor is it going to be just man getting to, you know, extract from the land without giving back. Okay, so my daughter is 7 and she's obsessed with, she plays Animal Catcher, and there's a point to this.
Okay.
She is, we have 2 dogs. And she's forever like trying to corral them. Seriously, like, I mean, this is her big game with Animal Catchers. Is, you know, she'll use pillows, she'll use real dog fences, chairs to try to trap them. Guess how well that works, right? The dogs keep getting out, and I have no idea why she's so obsessed with this, but she does. Well, nature's the same way. I keep trying to put in these nice little neat boxes. And it keeps getting out of the box and, you know, consuming the house that I've just lived in, right? You know, it's just because of the way I think about it that I'm missing the point.
Can you think of any, like, any big real world examples of that sort of thing?
As a gardener, I'm never a fan of a one size fits all solution. Because in my experience, it just doesn't work. Long term, you know, every land manager has to have a whole toolbox of options, solutions, you know.
Yeah.
And because every site is unique, there is no one, obviously, you know, no one size fits all.
Yeah.
But the point is that if I understand the science and I understand the principles that then I need to apply based on what the science is telling us, And just as importantly, more importantly, what my observations of the actual site are telling me.
Mm.
Then I can craft a solution that involves multiple layers. Ecosystems are built on multiple layers. So if you try to do a one layered solution, it's not going to address the whole system, and you're going to get feedback from the system that counters your efforts.
Yeah.
And so you might as well craft a puzzle piece that actually fits into the whole puzzle, right? Rather than only part of it. As a director of horticulture at a botanic garden, previous job, we took a multi-pronged approach. First of all, we started with what's the definition of a weed.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a plant out of place, plant where I don't want it.
Yeah.
So a plant, a species in one garden or context was a weed, and another it wasn't. So we pulled it, we treated it differently, depending on the location.
Yeah.
Right. So that was part of it, was change of that. Then we took a more low-till, no-till approach to our ornamental and food production bed systems.
Mm-hmm.
So that the less we were disturbing the soil, the less weeds we were going to have.
Mm-hmm.
So we were using, cover crops on a limited basis, but obviously covering the soil. I would call it soil cover, with organic amendments, mulch, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Right. So that we add that layer and that tool into it.
Yeah.
We very limitedly used chemicals. Mm-hmm. We focused on inoculating the soil with beneficial bacteria and fungi and so forth to get a robust soil ecology going.
Yeah.
So with the assumption, again, this is an area where science needs to do even more research on. But the assumption being, and I realize I'm not doing this not with tons of scientific data, that, a crowded table, there's not a lot of room for others to eat at, right? If the planet's full, there's not a lot of room, right? The hotels, there's no vacancies.
Yeah.
Go down the road. So there's that. And the way we plant, we try to plant with as much close, cover, so there's not a lot of space between plants, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all of these things. It's not one particular answer, but you're creating a whole design system, mm-hmm. cultural practice system around which to limit the amount of weeds. Also, just coming in with the goal that, zero, in most cases, zero eradication,
yeah.
Good luck, right? It's more of down to IPM thought of, tolerance level, threshold level,
mm-hmm.
right? So management rather than eradication, unless it's a new thing introduction, and I can eradicate it successfully,
mm-hmm.
was more of the goal.
Okay.
Right. Even in my woodland garden, mm-hmm. I wasn't trying to get rid of all the garlic mustard. Good luck.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
But I was getting it down to a level. Through multiple approaches, roguing or hand removal, some cases spraying, and then bringing in natives, replanting.
Yep.
Okay. Trying to fill that vacuum quicker.
Yep.
That and we were focused on getting our mean C of conservation up, and our FQI. So there we were measuring. We had it through transects and plots.
Yeah.
Actually measuring, quantifying our success.
Right, right.
Right. We had end goals.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't, what you can't quantify, you can't manage. So all of those things we were trying to build a whole approach around.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we were, I don't know how successful we were doing, but where we were quantifying,
yeah.
I know we were making improvements in our soil, and I know we were making improvements in the woodland garden specifically as a conservation project, and overall invasive species had to put a concerted effort into it.
Yeah.
But as soon as we were to abandon that and walk away, what's going to happen? it's going to revert, right? It's, yeah. I mean, that's the, like I say, like if the humans that are involved, if these are highly human dependent design systems, they're going to fail because humans are going to fail.
Hmm.
So you got to get one that is self-perpetuating.
Right, right.
That's where the ecological design approach comes in. That was my long tirade. Why did you put the soapbox at my right here for me to stand on? I just don't. And seriously,
oh,
I mean,
yeah, that one.
Yeah, the one that I've been standing on this whole time. I, you know, I can sit in a chair, you know.
All right, you ready to do the outro?
Yeah, let's do outros.
Yeah, you can start it.
What am I saying again?
Our Rich Land is a production of...
Oh, yeah. Give me the script. You probably have it memorized.
I don't, actually.
Oh, well, we'll pass it back and forth.
There you go. You know? Okay.
Our Rich Land is a production of Richland Soil and Water Conservation District in Mansfield, Ohio, in partnership with Kingwood Center Gardens, also in Mansfield, Ohio. Our director of Kingwood Center Gardens is me.
It's you.
Yeah, so...
And our director is Erica Thomas. Public relations coordinator is Teresa Suter. So she helps kind of promote this podcast on our social medias.
Oh, and if you want to like get the details of what we were rambling about and pretended to have some knowledge of, but you want to get the fact checks, check our show notes for more accurate and detailed information on all kinds of topics.
Yes, and more specifically, Malabar Farm Foundation's website is linked there. It is a wealth of additional knowledge on Louis Bromfield, his farm, his life, and the sustainable agriculture and conservation he practiced and promoted. We barely did that justice, so go check that out. And also, if you get the chance, pick up a copy of Louis Bromfield's Pleasant Valley. I actually just found a copy of this book, and I'm really excited to get into it and to learn about sustainability from the writer's own perspective. Also, we are linking a website on permaculture design principles, something Josh touched on, the book Founding Gardeners by Andrea Wolf, and a few websites where you can further explore regenerative agriculture and horticulture. Richland Soil and Water Conservation District is a not-for-profit organization offering education and technical guidance to residents and landowners for their natural resource needs in Richland County, Ohio. Our numerous events, programming, publications, informational videos, stormwater permit applications, and much more can be found on our website, richlandswcd.net. That's richlandswcd.net.
And, you know, if you want to learn more about Kingwood Center Gardens in Mansfield, Ohio, feel free to please come. It's also a not-for-profit. We're a 501c3, too, you know. public garden in Mansfield, Ohio. Been there for 69 years, since 1953, producing wonderful displays with both perennial and annual displays, but also our natural areas and historic mansion.
And peacocks.
And peacocks. Yeah, and a duck pond that's getting revised. We've got education events or educational programs and events, as well. And, it's just a great place for, sanctuary and establishing and enriching deep connections with nature. You can, get more information at kingwoodcenter.org.
And as always, everybody, thanks so much for listening.